Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable panel for this Monday, the 28th of December. Very nice to have you with us on this fine day, the last Monday of calendar year 2020. And hopefully, those of you who had a few days off had a lovely holiday celebration. We would like to wish everyone a happy Kwanzaa, which we will celebrate today and throughout up until for the next several days. And we wish you the best and the happiest of holidays, as well as the new year, which comes up later in the week. So a lot going on, and we hope that you are safe and sound and happy and joyous and all of that good stuff. We will try to do all of those things while we talk about rather depressing topics, but we'll try to rise above it and do our best. Just a quick programming note. Our panel will go till 10:30 this morning, and then we are going to be running our Kwanzaa special that we run every year called A Season's Griot. And we will hear that at 10:30. And then at 11:30 this morning, the governor is expected to hold a press conference, and we will hear his update on the coronavirus pandemic. So all of that coming up on the program this morning. Let me introduce our group to you, and then we'll get started with the topics for today. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. We've spoken already this morning when our group gets together every morning, and we try to figure out what we're going to do to stay alive at WAMC. And one of the things that we know is that there are an awful lot of people who are saying, okay, it's the end of the year. I have a potential for some tax deduction, but really, that's not the reason why. I got to keep this radio station alive because it's a big part of who I am and what I do. And we really want to thank everybody who's done something already. It's just so great to hear from everybody.
WAMC.org is the easiest way to do it. And I sneezed. I apologize. And that's the easiest way to do it. You can also, of course, give us a call, 1-800-323-9262, and do it that way as well. But WAMC.org is the easiest way to do it.
It is.
You can also just mail us a check, and all the information is online for the address and so forth. But yeah, you know, we've already heard from folks who are anticipating, and we'll of course talk about this in just a minute, but anticipating a stimulus check and saying that, well, they don't really want it. They would rather it go to us than into somewhere else. So that is very nice. We heard that during earlier this year in the first stimulus. So, but whatever works for you. And this is always, you know, this will really, whatever goes in now is less that we have to make up during that February fund drive, which will be the all-important February fund drive.
You bet.
All right. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. Okay. So we also want to welcome to the proceedings Libby Post, our dear friend, political consultant. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing okay. You know, just living the dream or the nightmare whatever it is that we want to call this.
Well, hopefully it'll change direction. But yes, we
yes.
Hope you're happy and had a beautiful couple of days. And good to hear your voice. We go to Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick. How are you?
I am fine, Joe. How are you? I'm happy to be with you today.
You know, this happened to me three times over the weekend, let's say mid last week to over the weekend. I passed you while you were running. Now, it is bad form for me to stop and say hello, right? You just want to keep going.
We just want to keep going.
Okay.
That's true.
All right.
And, yeah.
I didn't want to seem rude that I was passing you by while you were running. But you and your sister, you run, and you run really fast. And I feel sometimes like I should stop and say hi, and then I feel, oh, well, if she recognized me, then she's going to think I'm you know, a jerk for not saying hello. But I get the idea you don't want to be bothered.
You know, I run with my head down. It's my sister who notices who's who, and she is the one who will point you out. And because I'm looking at the pavement in front of me, she's looking at the crowd, waving to people she knows, and I just want to get this run done.
Okay, all right. Well, now that you know you don't hate me for it, I feel much, much better.
And I can only say that I do walk every day, 4 miles, 5 miles every day, and I pass a lot of people I know. And everybody sort of understands. You just sort of give them a wave, and that's all. Maybe a salute.
I would just like to point out that the Judy's usually going faster than I am in my car.
Right.
That's not true.
immigration attorney and associate with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. I do not run.
Well, nor do I, but it's nice that other people do. Good for you.
But walking is very good. Walking is very, very good. In fact, most of what I'm reading now says walking, here goes a fight, walking is better than running because it's less difficult on your feet and your knees. And if you walk at a fairly moderate to fast pace, you're doing good.
Just getting out
so
there.
So Alan is trying to one-up me on this.
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, good morning, all. It's very nice to have you with us. Always a pleasure. And we get together on this final Monday of 2020. So you'll remember when last we met on the panel, we were talking about the stimulus bill that the president had just called a disaster and said that the $600 was the stimulus was silly and that it had to go to $2,000, and he refused to sign it. And it was just a disaster and the worst thing, and yesterday he signed it. So that kept us from a shutdown, which is good, and a lot of back and forth over a holiday as to really what was going to go on. There were some very strange stories. I mean, the end result is that it was signed by the president into law, averting a shutdown. That's the headline. But getting there was not easy. And there were just these weird stories that, and I think on Christmas Eve, that they had set up a room at Mar-a-Lago, and they had the desk, and they had the pens, and they had the table, and they were ready to go. And I think this one was actually a bigger table than the last time, and it was all good. And then they just scrapped it and said the president changed his mind. And then finally, I think after a lot of consternation, was passed last night. He had demanded changes to the stimulus bill, but on Monday moved to release the stimulus funds after all. Alan, I'm sure that this will not be the final time, but it may be one of the final times that I ask you, what do you think was going through the president's mind during all of this?
Well, we pretty well know that this is a guy who always believes that what you want to do is dominate the headlines. Think about this. We have an incoming president of the United States. He's making all of these important decisions. He's talking about which of the Trumpian nonsense he's going to turn around on day number one. He's talking about who his major players are going to be, and it's all Trump all the time. That is what Trump wants. He wants his puss in the papers at every single moment. And just yesterday we were hearing definitive rumors coming out of the White House that he would announce his run for president on the day that Biden is inaugurated. The man has no class whatsoever. He has no responsibility. He has no responsibility. I got a note from a guy yesterday. It was kind of weird, saying that he had heard my interview with Tom Paxton and how wonderful Pete Seeger and the rest of it. If I was that nice to Tom Paxton and Pete Seeger, why wasn't I being nice to the president of the United States? Why was that? Because this guy is a monster. M-O-N-S-T-E-R. Monster. This is what this is all about. It's all about him. It's all about bringing as much attention to himself as he possibly can. And that's what he did. But we'll never know whether Mitch McConnell or some of the Republicans in this in the Senate said, okay, you know, you're going to do this to us. We have some things we can do with you. We don't know that, and we never will, probably.
Sienna.
Oh, I agree with Alan. It was disappointing to hear because it was just attention grab. What it did was delay the ability to issue the stimulus checks, and everything gets rolled back another week, and people go without funds for another week. And it was sad to see because he ended up signing the basic same bill that was there last week. It was an attention grab for me. I agree with Alan on that one.
Libby Post.
Well, he did his usual shtick, and that's why, Joe, I emailed you this morning and asked you the question that I asked you, because I really wanted to say it on the air, but, I mean, it's
it was a bad
usual,
word.
It was a bad word. It's one of those seven words you can't say on broadcast, but, you know, this is his modus operandi. I'm going to create a problem, and then I'm going to solve that problem. So... you know, he created this problem of I'm not going to sign it because they should have $2,000. I mean, who's he kidding, right? Knowing full well what was in the bill, or if he doesn't, then it's just one more reason that why he should possibly be removed from office a little early. But then he solved the problem. So he looks, to his base at any rate, he looks like a hero. You know, that base will find out how much of a hero he is when they don't get their money that they expected on time. Not that $600 is going to pay anybody's rent or anything like that. It'll put food on the table, but it won't pay the rent. And thankfully, there was a moratorium, eviction moratorium in the bill, but also the Senate and the Assembly in New York State are coming back today virtually to pass a long-term moratorium, I think, until the end of May. And so, you know, it's just his usual look-at-me antics. We shouldn't expect anything less or anything more.
Judy Patrick.
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said, but also he has created enormous political chaos. Imagine what the Republicans are going to have to deal with from now on. What's going to happen to Republicans fighting for Senate seats in Georgia? And what's going to happen to the Republicans in the Senate when they're presented with a bill to increase these checks to $2,000? This really puts them on the spot. And I think President Trump has no capacity to understand the damage he's inflicting on what once was the grand old party, the Republicans.
So let me ask a question to the group, and Alan, we'll start with you. But the New York Post, of all publications, today on its front cover says, the Post says, Mr. President, stop the insanity. You lost the election. Here's how to save your legacy. In that article, it says, Mr. President, it's time to end this dark charade. We're 1 week away from an enormously important moment for the next 4 years of our country. On January 5th, two runoff races in Georgia will determine which party will control the Senate. Unfortunately, you're obsessed with the next day, January 6th, when Congress will, in a pro forma action, certify the Electoral College vote. You have tweeted that as long as Republicans have, quote, courage, they can overturn the results and give you four more years in office. In other words, you're cheering for an undemocratic coup. You had every right to investigate the election, but let's be clear, those efforts have found nothing. To take just two examples, your campaign paid $3 million for a recount in two Wisconsin counties, and you lost by 87 more votes. Georgia did two recounts of the state, each time affirming Biden's win. These ballots were counted by hand, which alone debunks the claims of a Venezuelan vote-manipulating conspiracy. Sidney Powell is a crazy person. Michael Flynn suggesting martial law is tantamount to treason. It is shameful. That coming from the New York Post.
Yeah, the New York Post is going to have to do business with Joe Biden for 4 years now. I mean, obviously, I don't want to start talking about motivation. I think it's just the guy is Trump is just so is turned out to be so insane. And by the way, he may think he's knowing what he's doing, so that when we say somebody is insane, it may well be that they are conscious of what they're doing. But they're still insane to do it if you're following this double, triple, quadruple fake out. I mean, that's the way that it works. So Trump is a guy who is going to continue to do this because that's the way that he operates. As for Murdoch and the Post, you know, I mean, I think that this is just too much for them and too much for the rest of the country.
Judy.
You know, I couldn't imagine that the transition would have been as bizarre as it has been. And now I'm sitting here hoping that nothing else extraordinary will happen before January 21st. But you've got to know that things are going to take an even crazier turn, but we don't know what it's going to be. And that's what has a lot of Americans on pins and needles at this point. It is incredible the amount of chaos, again, the word chaos, that he has caused. And I will go to my grave trying to understand how anybody could be that needy for attention or for control or for power. I understand it's happened in history before, but Donald Trump is not a smart guy. How did he reach this height of power? And it's not just, you know, and we like to blame just him, but he had a lot of enablers, and I think it's time for those enablers to be held to account.
So that seems like the big question. Libby, we only have about a minute, but when you talk about those enablers, do you think, as evidenced by what the New York Post is saying, that maybe some of them are starting or will have to change their tune?
Well, I think, you know, if we're successful in Georgia, they're going to have to change their tune. That big time, but I do think that they are going to have to temper what they say. They can't be so pro-Trumpian during a Biden administration because they'll just be seen as obstreperous. It'll be interesting to see what happens on January 6th, how many of them really are going to challenge the Electoral College. Tommy Tuberville, as we all know, is a moron, and so he's going to do the president's bidding. You know, but other than that, we'll see how things go. But they're all going to have to take stock because people are hurting. And more than that, people are dying in this country because of Trump's negligence.
I wish you hadn't said Tommy Tuberville.
Why? Because of his name?
Because it gets into my head, and then I go around muttering Tommy Tuberville all day.
Oh,
cleanse yourself, Alan. Just go into a Zen moment.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll continue with our wonderful panel. Alan Shartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Judy Patrick, and Libby Post. We welcome your letters as well. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Shartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Judy Patrick, and Libby Post. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Let's see. Let's go to some letters. In all seriousness, asks Eric, when does treason enter into the conversation? Are we so immune to the idea that this concept is unimaginable in our current day and age? And what are the chances the United Nations brings charges of crimes against humanity against Trump for his deliberate misinformation campaign against his own people, resulting in over 250,000 American lives and counting?
Well, it seems to me treason is a possibility based on incoming information. We don't have it yet, but we're going to get more as the Biden administration moves into position. There will be people in various agencies, justice, our security agencies, who will be able to put something on the table. And if it could be proven, and this is the big if it could be proven that there is a relationship between Trump and the Russians that has mitigated his work here in the United States and what he has said, I think there's a possibility that you could find some treason.
Sienna?
I wouldn't go so far as to say treason, but what we do know is that they are down in the Attorney General of New York is working on cases right now against Trump, as well as in the Southern District is still working despite his moving around the Attorney General. They're still working on those cases. And so I think what's going to happen is you're going to start very small with these local New York cases. And then it's going to get bigger and bigger as things come out. He no longer has that protection of the White House.
And I think that's what, you know, could potentially open up Pandora's box for him and his family.
We go to Robert, who says, what do you think will happen to the House members that blocked the vote held last week to raise the stimulus amount to $2,000? I doubt anything will come of it since we have very short memories.
That's a tough one. Go ahead, please.
Well, I'd rather see something be done for the 126 members who signed on to this stupid lawsuit to overturn the election. I mean, you know, read recently that during Lincoln's time, there were a handful who didn't support something or didn't support the Electoral College or something to his becoming president, and they were not seated in the 1850s, 60s. And so, you know, we should maybe look at that. But I want to get back to the crimes against humanity issue.
Yes.
I think the UN should take this up. We'll have a different UN ambassador. Our UN policy will be do a complete 180. And he has perpetrated crimes against humanity. He's put children in cages, separated them from their parents, and then we have COVID. Those are crimes against humanity as far as I'm concerned.
Frank writes that Trump was right to point out that $2,000 checks would have been better. Dems got outlefted again. That from Frank in New Jersey.
I don't think so. They immediately said, that's a good idea, Mr. President. We want the $2,000.
Yeah.
And they voted for it. I don't think they got it. I think my own view of this is that Trump had decided that he's madder at the Republicans for not defending him more than at the Democrats. And therefore, he was going to embarrass them and he was going to put them on the spot. And that's what this is all about. But I don't think he ever meant it. I think the whole idea was to make sure that it didn't happen at all. And that's where it damn well almost came to happen. But of course, in the end, somebody must have been leaning on him.
Judy, this one's for you. Greg writes, how can Judy fault Trump for seeking power when our next president has been doing just that for his 50 years in politics?
Well, there's a strong difference between seeking a political position and seeking to acquire as much power as possible and to use it in egregiously inappropriate or unethical ways is my position. It's this whole idea of trying to disrupt an election, to overturn an election. I mean, that's how much more egregious can you get than that?
We go to Matt, who says, I totally agree with Dr. Allen on the substance of his complaints against Trump, but his use of dehumanizing language such as evil and monster are also profoundly unhelpful as well.
No apology. I mean it. I said it. I think this guy is out to really harm the American people because of his own expense. And I think that's what makes him all of that. Just too bad. I mean, you know, I'm going to say what I'm going to say. And if somebody doesn't like it, they can write a letter and we'll read it.
Russ says Trump's signature on the continuing fiscal bill marks the end of legislative progress. Without Trump's pension for unfunded federal largesse, with the imminent return of the Republican majority through the Georgia Senate races, and with new and determined Trumpist members in the House, the outlook is for a prolonged glacial retreat in Congress. McConnell will unquestionably resume his obstruction at any cost strategy to prevent a Democratic initiative. Of course, that a lot still rides. Was it 9 days from today, right? Is that, or 8 days from today of the Georgia race? So.
And while we're talking about things that are coming up, Joe, there is this increasing chatter, internet chatter, about what Mr. Pence is going to do as the presiding officer when the two houses come together, and that Trump has had his conversation with Pence. Does Pence have the, cojones to stand up to the president and say, no, you lost the election, like the New York Post is today? Or is he going to give in and to the president and try to really throw a bomb here? What do you think, gang?
I'm thinking I would love to read the book that Mike Pence is going to write.
Oh,
if he ever does write one, because he's got a lot of splaining to do, as we say.
I think Pence is going to stick with Trump on this one. I think, especially with Trump saying he's going to announce to run for re-election in 2024, you know, Pence has some skin in the game, so to speak, to stick with Trump for the next 4 years. That's my opinion. He always is right behind Trump, so that's my.
So he has no choice, right? He has no moral ability to say, you know, this is, we're talking about, we used the word treason before, but something close to that, upsetting the peaceful transference of power and all the rest, and I'm going to be part of that because my own political agenda comes first. Is that what you're saying? I guess you're right.
Look what happened. He was in charge of the COVID task force. He was placed in charge of the COVID force here in the White House, and he did not step up. He followed right behind President Trump. We thought that was the time for Pence to shine, and we didn't get to see him at all. So I don't think he's going to step up this time.
Legal experts say that Pence has absolutely no authority, constitutional or otherwise, to prevent ratification of the Electoral College votes. The Constitution states that Pence shall, in the presence of the Senate and House Republicans, open all the certificates and the votes shall then be counted. The shall in the provision is an imperative command, unambiguously requiring the act to be completed, making Pence's role merely ceremonial. But even if he tries something and it doesn't happen, he has still pledged his allegiance, correct?
Well, yeah. And what if he says, I'm calling off this this meeting right now because of yuck, yuck, and yuck. What exactly happens then? In other words, yes, the Constitution says it, but I don't care what's in the Constitution, he says. And we haven't cared what's in the Constitution up to now.
Then do we go to court?
Oh, boy. And does that...
I don't believe so. I think it goes back to the state. I believe that's what happens for them to certify it. Not certify it, but it goes back to the state. That's
yeah,
where
but
it goes
then,
after that.
But so, then how does the whole thing get certified? You understand what I'm saying? In other words, right now, this is supposed to be nothing more than a mundane, you know, here's the stamp. So you say it goes back to the states. The states will have already signed off on this and said what they think. But where does the final act happen if this dumbcuff, vice president, turns around and now says I'm calling this certification off? What happens then?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, going back to the idea, though, that he can't, that he really has no, if he has no ability to do it, then does the rest of the House just take over and say, okay, it's done?
Somebody would have to get a motion on the floor, and somebody would have to pass it, and I don't know how that happens. You know, this
well,
is, again,
let,
please, go ahead.
Let's not forget. If there is no duly sworn-in president on January 20th, Nancy Pelosi is the next in line. Trump's term is over. Nancy Pelosi becomes president.
The 12th Amendment merely designates the president of the Senate, the VP, to open all the certificates, but then uses the passive voice, the votes shall then be counted. Right. Implicitly, Congress does the counting. This according to Fordham Law professor and legal historian Jed Sugarman. He goes on to say the president of the Senate, saying that the Electoral Count Act is more detailed on the count process. And this goes back to the Electoral Count Act of 1887, for those of you keeping score at home. So I'm reading this to mean that, according to legal experts, he has to just say, okay, we're opening the votes, and then at that point the House takes over and counts them.
Well, If I had a dime for every legal expert who's proven not to to underestimate Trump and his what he does, you know, I'd have $1.50, something like that.
Another... I also think it's very telling. It's very telling that he alienated Congress, the senators, the Republican senators, just this week by his actions. So I don't think they're going to be looking favorably towards him on January 6th.
So what are their choices?
He doesn't have free.
So assuming you're right, we're assuming that he alienated them. We're sure he did. They took a look at the research, at the polls, and the Republicans who were standing by Trump. What did they do then? Did they give up their careers? Because he's already said, anybody who crosses me, I'm running a primary against you.
Well, this Sorry is where to... they have to put country over party.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Half to schmaff.
You know. I know. Well, I know. It's true. But that, I mean, this is the Solomon-like choice that they have. And... some of them will and some of them won't. It's a lot of conjecture. I was on a call with Chuck Schumer earlier last week after the show, and he feels confident that everything's going to just move along without a problem. Because I asked him specifically, did he think that there could be a coup based on our conversation last Monday? And he said no, that things should move along as they are supposed to, and that what was very funny, and many of us agreed, that the military hates Trump, so they're not going to stage a coup on his behalf. I just think that I think many of us will just keep going and going and going, and then January 6th will come, and we'll be wringing our hands, and they'll try something, and they're not going to be successful. They have yet to be successful.
And then they'll come up with something else between the 6th and the 20th to figure out.
And then, right, and the Supreme Court will say, see ya, because ultimately this will end up in the Supreme Court, and they've already said, see ya.
Well, we do see him fooling around with the Iran card. You know that, Libby, right? And so he's been talking about it, and he says, if they do this, then I'm not going to put up with that, this kind of thing. And that's a pretty good indication, as his niece and sister and others have said, that when he says something and he threatens it, he often does it, if not all the time.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have more letters, a couple on the UN and what we were talking about, that crimes against humanity and the like. We will get to those and more. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Judy Patrick, and Libby Post making up the panel this morning. And we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. And we do have some letters here that I want to get to before the top of the hour. Mike writes and says, wouldn't crimes against humanity charges under the UN's auspices require U.S. ratification of those international treaties? There are a number of which have affirmed, but Congress never ratified, keeping the U.S. off the international hook. We then go to Mike, who said, I understand the point Libby is making about crimes against humanity as far as the pandemic is concerned. However, to the best of my knowledge, the U.S. does not recognize the authority of the International Criminal Court, so I think such desire is fruitless.
Well, it does when it's not our people. I think it recognized against during the Balkans, and I think, I can't remember his name, but the president of one of the countries that did ethnic cleansing, he was brought to justice, and I think we stood by them for that.
But most likely nothing will happen, right?
Yeah. I mean, it would be one more thing. I mean, so if they did it and they charged him with crimes against humanity, the question who remains would be U.S. extraditing to The Hague. Blah, blah, blah. But it's just one more nail in his political coffin or one more feather in his cap. So according to how you look at it.
Good point. All right.
Well, I think the best thing Libby just said is blah, 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 because I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think it's going to go to the United Nations. I tell you right now, a lot of people who are listening to this program right now appropriately feel that anything that happens to him is fine in terms of a political process. Nevertheless, it just doesn't seem to me. My instinct is that doesn't happen.
All right, let's go to some other topics here, and we just have about 5 minutes before we go to our top of the hour break. I do want to talk about the Nashville blast. This was the ugly story out of Nashville, Tennessee, that happened on Christmas morning. DNA tests of human remains found at the scene match a 63-year-old Nashville man identified as a person of interest in the explosion which ripped through downtown Nashville on Christmas morning. Anthony Warner is the bomber, says Donald Cochran, the U.S. attorney for the Middle District of Tennessee. At a news conference on Sunday afternoon, he was present when the bomb went off and he perished in the bombing. Law enforcement officials said there is no indications of anyone else being involved in the bombing, and the investigation continues into possible motives behind it. The sprawling inquiry has included hundreds of federal agents and officers pursuing more than 500 leads since Friday morning. Federal agents searched a home Saturday belonging to Mr. Warner in Antioch, Tennessee, roughly 11 miles from the site of the blast. Images of the same building from March and May captured on Google Street View show an RV in the yard that appears similar to the one that the police say was detonated. Mr. Warner's employment history includes experience working with electronics as an information technology expert for Nashville area businesses. The president of one of those businesses said that Mr. Warner sent an email to the firm on December 5th saying that he was retiring. Investigators found that Mr. Warner had recently given away a car he owned and told someone close to him he had cancer, though it was not clear whether he truly did have cancer. Financial records show that Mr. Warner purchased components that may have been used in the bomb. Mr. Warner is also was in the burglar alarm business that was registered in Tennessee from 1993 to 1998. And this was all done, the RV is detonated on the curb in front of an AT&T transmission building on 2nd Avenue North in Nashville. The image shows the vehicle moving through downtown with its headlights on, the white camper illuminated by streetlights and glowing storefronts. I'm sure many of you have seen the video that has been posted, various video that has come out. A Nashville police officer came upon the vehicle several hours later. He was responding to reports of gunfire. Instead, he found the RV with a speaker warning that a bomb was inside and that it was about to detonate. A tragic story, and I'm sure we'll find out more about this as time goes on. It does seem that if you do something like this on Christmas morning, if there is any good to come out of a story like this, that he was not looking to harm a great number of people.
Well, you know, what this proves to me is that, you know, with 300 million people out there, you're going to get a lot of characters who have this kind of expertise, and we do know that suicide has become a major factor in our society. So this is suicide by bomb, and it certainly is troubling in that he's not the only one who had the ability or equipment to do that. There is often, imitation stuff that happens afterwards. Very scary.
A great deal of destruction caused AT&T outages. It halted flights. It pretty much turned everything off on Christmas morning. Service outages that continued even on Saturday. And the explosion affected some cell service across parts of Tennessee, Kentucky, and Alabama and hindered the communication of 20 or more 9/11 centers, according to the governor. And AT&T saying that they've been able to make as much progress. The Times has a New York Times has a pretty good picture, a map in the paper this morning, where it shows the area of the blast and just how much of the city was impacted, and the extent of the debris and the fallen trees that came as a result of the parking right in front of the AT&T transmission building. Libby.
It's mind-boggling. I mean, clearly he didn't want to hurt people, I would hope, based on the timing he did this, but, you know, really going after property. If he wanted to kill himself, he just should have, I mean, I don't mean to sound callous, but stay home. Do it at home. I mean, I just don't understand why bring an RV down and blow it up and cause all that damage. Did he not believe in people owning property? I mean, I have no idea. Thankfully, there were some cops around, and they worked to evacuate folks from the apartment. But it was just a senseless act. And I'm still sort of befuddled. And I've been watching the videos, and it was quite the explosion.
One of the things some of the investigators in the FBI have said that one of the things that they are following is that there was what they're referring to as quote unquote 5G paranoia, concerns about the impact of 5G, and wondering if that was behind the Nashville bombing and the concerns over that technology, which is a real thing in the sense of that people are very concerned about aspects of it. So,
well, when they do all the forensics on his computers at home, it'll be interesting if he's got any browser history for QAnon.
We shall see. Yeah. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and we'll do so with our panel, Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Judy Patrick, and Libby Post. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us, Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Judy Patrick, and Libby Post. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Bobby writes, if Mike Pence ever wants to seek office again, he will follow the law and Constitution, all in shouty caps. And Vesta writes, Republicans have mostly stayed silent, ran from cameras, or cheered Trump on for the last 4 years. This made it harder for them to distance themselves with each fresh new outrage. Trump has no bottom or shame, so he keeps raising the stakes and testing their loyalty to him. Susan Collins foolishly said he would learn his lesson from impeachment when the only Republican in Senate was Romney to vote for it. I think McConnell sees the bomb coming in the confirmation hearing, and I'm wondering how the panel sees the January 6th hearing play out. Well, we talked about that a lot, but I don't know if there's anything anybody wants to add. Go ahead, Sienna.
Sure. I was just looking into it because now Alan has me obsessed trying to figure out what happens when it goes back to the States. But Pence doesn't have to show up at all. If Pence doesn't show up, the longest serving senator for the majority party can reside. And I think that may be an option for Pence as well. He may not want to reside over the hearing where he has to confirm Biden, as president.
And how do you
think he may not even show up for the proceedings?
And how do you think Trump would feel about that?
Yeah,
that would be the death knell of all times, the self-imposed death knell. Can you imagine Trump hearing that his lapdog didn't show up?
Well, how much matters after January 20th?
Well, it depends. If you're a Republican United States senator, and this president has said, I will put somebody up against you in a primary, and that will be the end of your political career, and probably will. We've seen enough evidence of that. Then it would matter a great deal, especially if he keeps his coals hot by saying he's going to run in 4 years. That's the last thing that these cowardly, spineless people want to do.
Judy Patrick.
You know, I think Pence believes it's his political, it's his destiny to one day be president. But I also believe that he has no national standing without Trump, that he has hitched himself to that star, as so we may say, that he can't go anyplace without Trump. After when Trump leaves office, I think Pence is politically dead. But he can go, you know, back home, but he doesn't have I think he's nothing without Trump. But I do not think he's going to disrupt the Democratic process on January 6th. But I do hope, I think he hopes to save the day and resurrect himself somehow with Trump. I think he's got it in his head that, you know, God has ordained that he is going to be president someday.
Mm. And it has all to do with whether or not God calls him on the morning of January 6th and says, Mike, you should go and do your constitutional duty, or Mike, Trump needs to be president for another 4 years, which is not the likely phone call.
We go.
I'm sure he'll say, I heard from God. And I'm like, whenever anybody says that, I'm like, really, did he call you this morning? Because I'd like to get his phone number. So give me a break.
You have some things you want to discuss with God, do you?
Yes. Yeah.
Let's go. We just have about 20 minutes left here, so try to get in as many topics as we can. There is the story about the the UK variant of coronavirus, and we've been talking a lot about it. We talked a lot about it last week, and of course, the governor of New York State, who we are expected to hear from at 11:30 this morning, is quite concerned, and especially when it comes to flight. Of those coming into this country from England being tested banning flights in some cases. But this highly transmissible variant of the coronavirus was first detected in England and by today has already been documented in several European countries as well as Canada, Japan, Australia, and Lebanon, despite efforts to curb its spread through massive global disruptions in travel and movement. Fear over the fast-spreading form of the virus come in sharp contrast to a wave of hope sweeping countries and communities as vaccination programs are rolled out. Scientists do not think the British variant is more deadly or resistant to the current coronavirus vaccine. The variant has also been detected in France, Denmark, Spain, Sweden, the Netherlands, Germany, and Italy. In Canada, Ontario's chief medical officer announced Saturday that they had confirmed two cases, the first detection of the variant in North America. The patient, a couple, had no known travel history, meaning it was probably a case of community spread. While the United States has not yet reported a case, experts say it is probably because of the nation's very low rate of genetic sequencing of the virus to check for such changes, despite Americans leading the world in coronavirus infections and deaths. Beginning Monday, the U.S. government will require all travelers flying in from Britain to show proof of a negative coronavirus test taken within 72 hours of the plane's departure. Early in the pandemic, the U.S. banned travelers from China and European nations, among others, though by that point, the virus had already begun widely spreading undetected because of the limited U.S. testing. I do want to just key in a little bit to that one paragraph that I read of, while the United States has not yet reported a case, experts say it is probably because of the nation's very low rate of genetic sequencing of the virus to search for such changes. That is concerning, Judy, that we're not doing more in the scientific world of what's going on with this virus that is really ravaging the country.
It is astounding that there's so much we still don't know about this virus at this stage of the game. But again, it's a fairly new virus. Some of the research out of England is indicating that so this is a variant, not a new strain, which apparently, while it's incredibly contagious, people who've already had an earlier strain or an earlier round of it are not getting reinfected. But boy, I would like to bring home the point that it's still, maybe it's not as deadly, but it's deadly. The coronavirus is a deadly virus. It is killing thousands of us. We need to take every precaution we can. We need to not go out if we don't have to go out. I can't emphasize enough how much it's affecting all of our lives. And people who are energetic and have a lot of life to live, they are dying needlessly at this point. And this is far more contagious, so we have to even be more careful. And I'm glad that Governor Cuomo has taken some steps, but I also think that the American public, too many of us are too lax in terms of what we're doing to protect ourselves and to protect the people we love against this contagion. And again, this is a deadly virus. Don't be fooled by the people who, you know, have come away with mild cases. People are dying, and this is deadly. And now that we've got a more contagious strain amongst us, we need to, you know, we need to be even more vigilant.
Alan.
What she said, that's mm-hmm. exactly, I mean, that's exactly right. I meet foolish people all the time who think it's okay to get out, who think it's okay not to wear a mask. I see them. I see them in a supermarket. You know, I mean, it is beyond my comprehension that people are so blasé about this that they don't realize that one day they may wake up and say, I should have been wearing a mask. I should have done this or that. It is incredible to me. And on some level, we were talking about suicide before, it is virtually suicidal because you know that you've increased the odds of your dying by a lot.
Sienna?
I was just going to say that's why I'm encouraged by the new administration coming in and us getting back into working with the WHO. We need to start working with other countries. Our federal government has not been doing that thus far. And that's so important because look at France and the UK. They were able to coordinate about travel when the variant was announced. So it's important that we're able to communicate with our international community and coordinate, because what we're having is just it's a global pandemic. And so we need to approach it in a global way. And we haven't been doing that in the past year. So that's what I'm excited about, is the new administration's approach and cooperation with the global community.
But in the meantime, there are still foolish people who don't think they have to protect themselves or protect their families or their friends or anybody else. It's extraordinary. Yeah, I'm delighted that we've got a new administration which is going to take this seriously. But a lot of people can get infected and die in a month, that's for sure.
Libby?
There's not a lot more to say. I'm just glad we now have an administration that actually believes in science and, you know, and leave it at that.
All right. We'll leave it at that. Let's go on to a story that was in the Washington Post that I wanted to touch on. This is something I've been seeing that has been making the media rounds for a few days, and this was sort of the best article I've seen on it. But the targeted killings of journalists are on the rise across Afghanistan. This really started to look, when you look back at the year, since January, 11 Afghan journalists and media workers have been killed, making this one of the deadliest years for the country's rapidly growing domestic media corps since the end of Taliban rule in 2001. Recently, the pace has increased with 5 journalists killed in just the past 2 months. Last Monday, a freelance photographer was shot dead outside of his home in the city of Ghazni. In November, a journalist who worked for Radio Azadi, a former Tolo news anchor, two people were killed in separate magnetic bomb explosions, one in Kabul and one in Helmand. Fardan Omni, an anchor for Ariana News TV, lost his life a day after. Judy, I know you work, obviously, on some of these issues. How alarming is this, and what ultimately can be done?
Right. It is an incredibly important issue for us to talk about. In Afghanistan, it's the issue of, you know, controlling the narrative when you're at war or you're engaged in peace talks. And we also have to be concerned about when the Taliban was in control of Afghanistan, you know, the restrictions on the press were horrendous. And there's concern, you know, that things have been fairly the press has been active once the Taliban has been suppressed these last few years. But now, as it's come back into the picture, what's going to happen going forward? Now, and then you have the worldwide issue. We have President Trump. His attacks on the press has been one of the defining elements of his presidency. And he has led the way to encourage press attacks around the world, especially in, you know, dictatorship and other, you know, kind of regimes. The U.S. Press Freedom Tracker has tracked this, you know, it tracks it worldwide. So worldwide, journalists are killed, journalists are jailed. In the U.S., we have suffered in more so this year than we have in past years. American journalists do go to jail, but they don't go to jail quite as frequently as they do in some of these other countries. But it has been happening. The Committee to Protect Journalists has come out with a white paper encouraging the new president, Joe Biden, to create a special envoy to, you know, track press freedom throughout the world, to give a speech in which he emphasizes or reiterates the U.S.'s support of freedom of the press and its role in democracy. So there's been this call to action for the new president to take. We can't overestimate the amount of damage the current president has done to protecting ourselves, but we've just got to build it back up from the grassroots up. That means local radio, local newspapers. We have to start, you know, building trust, credibility in our communities step by step, and hoping we'll get some leadership from the new president.
Alan?
Well, it is a very complicated subject. There's no question that what the president has done is to lead an attack on the press. And of course, there is also no question that the press has not always behaved as responsibly as they could. As they would. I mean, I call Trump, out for what he does. And I get letters saying, you're being irresponsible. We have a right to put a stop to what you're saying. This is where we live right now. We remember that all the press is not the same. The New York Post is not the same as the New York Times or the Daily News. So when we lump everybody together and we say the press is being attacked, there's some pretty irresponsible press out there also, and that's something that we have to consider.
Libby?
Well, you know, yes, there's irresponsible press. There's no two ways about it. But we're talking about what's going on in Afghanistan.
No, you're right. That's right. They
don't want any kind of
right
freedom of expression or anything. I mean, you know, in Saudi Arabia, they just put the woman who campaigned for women to be able to drive in jail. I mean, it's astounding. I mean, what we have here in the United States, I was watching Brian Stelter. The media show on CNN. And they were talking about MAGA media versus everybody else, and how some of our folks have been incredibly irresponsible. Yet, adding to the tacit approval of attacking other media sources. We haven't seen wholesale murder yet, but we have seen the lumpen press, the whole notion that the press is evil in this country, and you know, we have to fight back against that. We do have the First Amendment, and you know, if what's interesting is what's happening now with Fox and Newsmax and OAN, and whether or not Trump does his own thing, you know, it's going to keep splitting that demographic more and more and more, which will make it harder for them to stay in business. But the attack on mainstream media, the media like the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post, and attacks on those folks have been ratcheted up. Nobody has been killed yet, and hopefully that won't happen. But what's going on in Afghanistan is par for the course for a strongman, autocratic, religiously bent government.
No, you're right. You're right. I mean, you're not going to compare what's happening in Afghanistan with what's happening here. But I just want to say that nobody gets a free ride. The press, we have had one person, Khashoggi, killed here, even though there is a pardon for that for the people who are probably responsible for that.
Yeah, right.
There is always a call for responsibility on the part of the press.
And I think by and large, the press is responsible.
Do you?
You will always have your bad actors in any industry, no matter where you are. You'll always have bad actors. You'll always have people trying to take advantage. But I think by and large, the majority of journalists are responsible. They believe in journalistic ethics. They believe in what they were taught in journalism school, and they're trying to make it work. And then there are people like, you know, Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson, who are, as far as I'm concerned, fake journalists. They're not really journalists. But, you know, you get to local level media all the way up, you know, the weeklies, all the way up to the New York Times. And I think that they are responsible, and they take their job of reporting the news seriously. And look, I've been on the other side of it, you know, because I'm a flack, and I try to get my stuff in the papers and the media to cover things the way I want it. But I know that they have a job to do, and I have a job to do, but I have yet to run into somebody on the local scene that is totally irresponsible. I think that there are some who have use the newspapers, the columns, for their own wherewithal and their own political agendas. But news gathering journalists in the local market, I think, are responsible. And I think the same thing for the larger papers and the larger media outlets.
Judy, is there anything you would like to add in the defense of your profession in our last 2 minutes?
Yeah, you know, I'd like to note that in the United States in 2020, there were 110 journalists who were arrested doing their job. There were 300 who were assaulted doing their job. Many of those cases, they were assaulted by police, and many of those assaults happened while they were trying to cover BLM protests. So it was an especially contentious time. It's that relationship between the police and the press is something we also need to consider carefully, and to see what's happened there, that a reporter can't go out and cover and provide information about what's happening on the streets of America without being assaulted.
Do you think that the I guess I'm interested in what and again, we only have about a minute, but the long-term effect of the enemy of the people label, and do you think that that will subside any over the next 4 years?
I think a lot of things are going to subside over the next 4 years. It's not going to go away completely, but it's something that the press can work to, again, I believe the press, we can restore our credibility. We just have to do it one story at a time. We do it at the local level. We build it up. We engage in conversations. Every Facebook post that calls us an enemy of the people, you need to step up and explain to them why we're wrong. We need to fight for ourselves, not just take the punches anymore.
And of course, Trump will still be out there, and he'll still be doing all of this, Judy. We know that. And he'll try to build his empire based on that kind of hatred of the improper hatred of the press, which is so important and such a huge part of the First Amendment.
We are out of time. I want to thank everybody. Coming up next, we have a season's griot. It is our annual one-hour Kwanzaa special. Madafa Lloyd Wilson has hosted this for the past 25 years and will continue to do so. We will hear that in just a few moments. Coming up at 11:30, we will have an update from New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo and the state's response to the coronavirus pandemic. My thanks to Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Judy Patrick, and Libby Post. Thanks to you all. We'll be back right after this.